You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is Andrea Pitzer, who has written three histories that are as distinctly different from one another as possible. Her first book was a history of writer Vladimir Nabokov, second, a history of concentration camps, and her latest, a history of the voyages of the 16th century Dutch explorer William Barents and his attempts to find a northeast passage to China through the Arctic. Ironically, in our lifetimes, an easy, iceless passage may actually occur, which Pitzer witnessed on her own travels tracing Barents' voyages, the third of which resulted in him and his crew being icebound on Novaya Zemlya Island, a long island north of Russia's Ural Mountains. His story of his voyages and the survival for nearly a year on this featureless island is recounted in her new book, Icebound, Shipwrecked at the Edge of the World. Pitzer uses diaries, archival materials, and her own trips to recreate the voyages. And they're a story of survival, 30 below temperatures, a lack of materials to build shelter, the effects of scurvy, and constant attacks by polar bears. While his crew made it home, Barents did not, and he never found a northern route to China. And today he lives on through the Arctic Sea that bears his name. The name of the book is Icebound, Shipwrecked at the Edge of the World. It's published by Scribner, and Andrea Pitzer is my guest today. Andrea Pitzer, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Rich.
I've found it interesting, in all three of your books, you've taken very different topics. What interests you in the explorations of Dutch explorer William Barents?
Well, it's interesting you brought up the three books because there's sort of a theme to them. And in my head, they're called the Zemlya Trilogy. And that's because in the first book I wrote about Vladimir Nabokov, the guy who wrote Lolita, there's a mystery kingdom in one of his novels that's called Zemlya, and it ended up being an important part of my first book to try to figure out what the heck is this Zemlya place. And one of the things I found in the real world that kind of matched up with it were these islands of Nova Zemlya north of Siberia above the Russian mainland, and that turned out to have kind of an important role in his life. But one of the things I found when I looked into the history of these Arctic islands that are up there was this story. Back in 2008, I found this story of these Dutch explorers who got stranded up there more than 400 years ago for the winter. And part of me was like, what an amazing survival challenge. You know, you think so long ago and they knew so little about the world. But also, I wondered, why did I never hear about this story before? Why was this new to me? And it had been in the back of my mind since then that I wanted to do it as a book at some point.
Yeah, William Barents, pretty much unknown to history, except if you're a geography nerd, you know that the Barents Sea is named for him. And his idea was that you could find a way to the Far East. Remember, this is the late 16th century, the last decade, 1590s, and every explorer is trying to find a shorter way to China, to the Far East. And he's trying to find a way through the Arctic, which sounds kind of absurd by today's standard, because now, well, actually today it may not sound so absurd, but certainly through most of history, we think of huge amounts of ice that would destroy ships. But what made him think that that was the quickest way to get to China and the best way to get to China?
Well, they had a little bit of impetus to think about going north because they were a new republic. It was a new Dutch republic in his time. They were really only a few years old, and they had declared independence from Spain. And they were still at war with Spain. This is a war that would last 80 years. It's called the 80 Years' War. And going south meant going into enemy territory. So going north, you know, they had a strong motivation to go that way to start with. But this idea that if you went far enough north, the sea might lose its ice and turn warm again went all the way back to the Greeks. And there is, I mean, it seems silly now, but there is a kind of a logic to it that they did understand even back in the Greek era, that the world was a globe and that it tilted toward the sun in summer at the north, and it would have endless sunlight during that period. And so the idea that sun might warm things up wasn't, you know, quite as preposterous as it seems to just imagine there would, for you and me to imagine, oh, there's just no ice at the North Pole. But as you mentioned, nowadays we're actually coming into where that's more and more of a reality. But in William Barents' day, he did three Arctic expeditions, and each time they were just assaulted by the ice. I mean, it was horrific. So in his day, that theory was a very mistaken theory with some pretty lethal consequences.
Well, how much exploration had been done about the far north at this particular time? You know, the obvious connection when you hear about Barents' story is the connection with Shackleton in the South Seas at the end of the 19th century. How much exploration had been done around the North?
Well, some people have heard of the attempts to find the Northwest Passage. So Martin Frobisher came up over northern Canada and tried to get through on three voyages there, which were really disastrous as well. So the British were working on it. The Dutch had sent some traders over trying to do this route, and they did end up establishing trade with Moscow through port cities in the north there. So you know, there had been some attempts to do this, but they had mostly at this point, if you were trying to go north over Scandinavia and then Russia to get to China, they mostly hugged the coastline and just found some new things along the way there. What was quite extraordinary about the Barents' voyages was this idea of striking out in a far northern way to sort of try to get through that barrier of ice and get somewhere closer to the pole and to try to cut that length of that voyage by not hugging the coast and just kind of going in as straight a line as possible. That's what was sort of new and adventurous. But the British and the Dutch were both very much angling and hopeful to try to make a northern passage possible because that'd be a huge trade advantage for them.
Yeah. Now, the goal wasn't necessarily to find the North Pole. It was just to use the idea that in the summer there would be 24-hour day sunlight, it would melt the ice, and there would be open water to basically cut the amount of time to China, right?
Right. So this was, you know, this was really a business proposition in this moment. But what I argue in the book, as I sort of go into the story of what happens to Barents and how it changes exploration history, is this idea. He kind of becomes the face of the first polar explorer, because I'll spoil the story a little bit here. He doesn't get to China, which you probably already guessed. He is turned back by the ice on the first two voyages. On the third voyage, they try to turn for home at one point, but on that third voyage, it's too late. They end up stuck for almost 10 months on Nova Zembla, about 200 miles north of Siberia, with more than an inch of ice on the inside, cabin walls, being stalked by polar bears. It's just an amazing survival story. And that story in time, I won't tell you who gets back to tell it, but it does make its way back to Amsterdam and is told. And the accomplishment that they have becomes not that they got to China or they established a trade route or they discovered a new continent or anything like that, like the older explorers, you know, were sort of honored by having done, but that they endured. So this idea of the guy who heads north, you know, to one of the poles and just has to survive the most harrowing ordeals. This becomes the face of the explorer going forward there. And he kind of sets that template. But it isn't, as you said, until the 19th century that that really explodes. And then he is known again for a little while, but he kind of gets lost to history.
And that template is, as you mentioned, very long. It's become sort of the template for most polar explorers.
It is. It is literally, you know, they're not going to invent a new thing. They're not going to make $1 billion for their king and bring back riches and jewels or exploit a bunch of indigenous people. They are literally going to map the unknown parts of the earth. And Barents kind of becomes the first person who does that. And while we're saying he gets, I mean, he is a little lost to history to us. In the Netherlands, he's still a national hero. And right after the story made it back, within 5 years, less than 5 years, Shakespeare is referring to them in Twelfth Night, one of his plays that he writes right at that time. And so it was seen as a legendary and you know, gargantuan accomplishment to have gone off of every known map and to have endured this winter and to come back and tell the tale. So in that moment, they were legends.
Yeah, and he did go way up into the north, probably from the Arctic Circle, close to halfway to the North Pole, up to Nova Zembla, which is this huge island north of Russia, Spitsbergen Island, which we think of well off the coast of Norway. So he did do some major exploration and gave us some interesting ideas about what was actually up north of the Arctic Circle.
It was, because it was really, in some ways, just an unknown world. They didn't know at that time, for instance, if there might be a whole polar continent, that they would get up there and there would be a giant additional continent, just as the Americas had been discovered. Maybe there was a North Pole continent. And so they made a lot of scientific discoveries along the way. On that third voyage, when they struck out straight for the pole from Europe, they did discover Spitsbergen, which is now the main island of Svalbard. And it is, as you said, about halfway between Norway and the North Pole. I did 3 Arctic expeditions myself, and I went up to Spitsbergen and did dog sledding in polar night on an expedition up there to try to get a sense of what is it like to be in polar night when the sun doesn't come up. And Barents was the first to map the shorelines of that island. He's, as far as we know in recorded history, the first person to see it. And so that expedition discovered a whole new place that became the heart between there and Greenland of a massive whaling industry that would grow up, that would really explode just about a decade after he made his last voyage. And then from there, when they couldn't get farther north because of the ice, he went back to where he had been on his first voyage, which was Nova Zembla, just a little bit south of Svalbard. And they managed to get north over the top of it. It's this long sort of hot dog-shaped island, and they got north over the top of it and onto the eastern side, and they saw this eastern sea, what is today the Kara Sea, and it was extraordinary. They thought that they were almost to China at that point, but that eastern side of Nova Zembla is, the sea is just so much colder. You have none of the Gulf Stream kind of coming over Scandinavia to keep things a little bit warm. And so what they found was just bitter ice all the way up and down the coastline, and they got stuck in. And then the polar bears are attacking them right away. The first one they saw, they thought they would keep as a pet, but they learned very quickly that that's not the way that polar bears work.
Yeah, some of the best parts of the book is their discoveries along the way. And one is polar bears, and as you mentioned, the first one, they thought they would bring it back to the Netherlands on their first voyage, and they soon found that polar bears and ships are not a good combination. But I want to talk about your own research to look at this area. You went on a number of trips to recreate Barents' journeys. Now, you had the journals that describe the trip they took. Was there any resemblance in the early 21st century?
Well, it was really interesting to go on. I didn't want to write the book if I wasn't able to go there myself, because I thought, if that's the case, then a career Dutch historian who has studied this for 30 years is just going to bring things to the book that I would never be able to. And so I thought, if I actually go there, then I would be able to bring the place alive in a way that might be unique and add something else to the story. So I went 3 times in all, and all 3 times I went to places where Barents had been, and each time I saw things that were both the same and different, so it was fascinating. On the first voyage, we did, that was actually a dog sledding expedition rather than a ship expedition. I went into the interior, and it was pretty incredible because it was January, and we went to an ice cave right at the beginning of our first day out, and we got trapped very briefly. It wasn't anything too scary, but by a cave-in, because there was rain in January, and it actually melted part of this ice ceiling that had probably been there for hundreds of years, maybe longer. And you're just not supposed to have rain in January in the high Arctic. And so that was the first sign that things really have changed in some ways. The second expedition I did up in the same region, I went on a tall ship, and I learned to work the sails and dead reckon a course. And, you know, I spent as much time as possible up the mast looking at that shoreline and imagine being the first person who would see this, and what would your impression of it be. But while I was up there looking at things, one of the things I saw a lot of was just trash. There's so much plastic trash on the shores up there that washes up from down here and moves northward. And that really sort of reminded me that we're in a different world now than Barents was, when this was, you know, a much more pristine place. And then on the third expedition in 2019, in August 2019, we actually sailed back to the ruins of their cabin on northern Nova Zembla. Part of the long timbers that were the base of the cabin are still there. And that was fascinating for a lot of reasons. One is that all our maps of the glaciers were out of date because the glaciers have receded so far from when those maps were made. We actually saw an island that I think very few people have probably seen so far, because it was only discovered recently when the glacier retreated back far enough to reveal that there had been an island under this part of it the whole time. But also, it was really interesting how things hadn't changed in some ways, because we went up around the Orange Islands, which are right at the northern part of Nova Zembla, these 2 little tiny, tiny islands. And right in the journal that Gerrit de Veer kept for William Barents on that third voyage, where he records them seeing walruses for the first time. They see hundreds of walruses right by these little islands. We came around by these little islands, and we saw hundreds of walruses more than 400 years later at exactly the same place. Now, those guys, their response to the polar bears and to almost everything they met was they went over the side of the ship into their small boats, and they went and they tried to kill as many as possible. They had never seen walruses, but they had heard that their tusks were valuable. so they were going to try to, you know, make money off this. Our response was quite different. One of the sailors went and got his little harmonica, it's like a small accordion, and played this Russian waltz for them. And they came over, and we had a walrus concert, which was one of the most amazing things I have ever seen in my life. It was really incredible. They were entranced, and they were sort of mosh-pitting into each other at one point, but they were completely transfixed. And so our reaction was a little bit different. But they were there. The walruses were there in the same place. However, when we got around the rest of the coastline to the ruins of Barrett's house, we were there a week or so before they had been in August when they got stuck more than 400 years ago, and there was no ice visible. So 400 years ago, the entire harbor was so choked with ice, it trapped their ship in and made it impossible to leave. And when we got there, just a few days earlier in August, there was no ice on the coastline there whatsoever.
My guest today is Andrea Pitzer, a journalist and author of three histories. Her latest book is Icebound: Shipwrecked at the Edge of the World. It's published by Scribner. It details the stories of William Barents, his trips in the 1590s as he tries to find a northern trade route to the Far East. And it is fascinating that on the final voyage, they become stranded on Nova Zembla, Long Island up in the Arctic, Russian island now. And basically spend most of a year stranded by ice. And that story is also very interesting. You mentioned you could see the foundations of the cabin. How did they survive in a place that's pretty barren? There are no trees. I guess there is some wildlife, but the main wildlife is polar bears, which are exceedingly difficult to kill, and walruses. You mentioned they were trying to kill walruses, and everything they tried to use to kill them, their thick hides basically was pretty useless in trying to kill them.
Yes, their blades were not not fully modern blades in terms of how well they were built, and so they found that the walrus hide was in some cases tougher than their sharp instruments the axes and the halberds that they would use to try to attack them with. And they also found that their guns were not quite up to snuff. They certainly wouldn't be by today's standards. They did have long guns, but they relied on an ignition mechanism still, and the aim was not so great. And so they learned that when a polar bear was charging them, they often had to wait till the polar bear was almost on top of them in order to fire to make sure that the aim would be true enough to hit the bear in a significant way. But then the problem is, as happened in one very dramatic time when the bear was trying to charge into their cabin, the powder wouldn't always ignite. And if the powder didn't ignite, then the gun didn't go off. So you were left waiting till the last moment to fire, knowing that the gun might not go off at the last second as the bear was charging. And so it was like a harrowing ordeal every time they had to deal with the bears, and they had to deal with dozens of them across time. And as you said, it's in this barren landscape. It's so far north that it essentially becomes this Arctic desert. Because there was not snow and ice on the ground when I was there, there were some very small bits of vegetation. There were Arctic poppies that were a couple inches tall, but there's no significant vegetation whatsoever. And when they were there, everything was covered in ice. And they did trap some Arctic foxes. And when they first landed, they realized the first thing that they needed to do was to have a shelter. But, of course, there's no trees. There's no way that trees could grow up this far north. So they were dependent on combing the shores for driftwood and taking some non-essential parts of their ship to make a cabin for themselves, which was its own whole adventure without any obstacles to start with. But one of the first things that happens is that the carpenter dies. So they just again and again are thrown from a bad situation into a worse situation. One of the things that I say in the book is that whenever something bad happened, there was always something worse waiting just around the corner. And so in that degree, this becomes a pretty incredible survival story that these guys who are pretty unequipped and pretty unwilling to learn from some of the native people that they meet on the way up. There are no indigenous people this far north in this part of the world, but they do meet some Nenets and some Sami people on their way there, and their reaction to them is to not sort of take a cue from the kind of clothing they're wearing. It's not to look at what they're eating or how they're doing anything. I mean, they're very convinced in this historical moment that their way, the European way, the Dutch way, is the right way to live, and they just create a lot of additional hardships for themselves through their lack of knowledge. At one point, they decide they don't like the taste of polar bear, so they don't eat polar bear during almost any of this winter, but then they're getting hungrier toward the end of that winter, and they decide when they catch one, they'll try the organ meat. So they eat part of liver. And it turns out that polar bear liver is incredibly toxic. It nearly kills three of the men. They all get sick. Nearly three of them die. And their skin peels off from head to toe. That's how lethal this is.
And their, you know, the amount of technology they had at the end of the 16th century is nothing compared to the technology, the polar explorers we think about in the late 19th century had. You know, they're basically learning about their environment as they get there.
They are, and they made some amazing scientific discoveries, especially given, as you said, the limited knowledge they had going. They could, for instance, very accurately reckon latitude, which is how far north or south of the equator you are, but they had no way on a moving ship to effectively estimate longitude, which is how far east or west of a given point you are. So they could find their way back to a place they'd been at before, but they would have to kind of sail around to get there. They would have to sort of do these workarounds for all the things that they didn't know. And yet, one of the neat things in their story for me is how many scientific discoveries they'd made. They were the first to figure out where these geese had laid their eggs, which sounds like a small thing, but nobody in Europe had ever seen these geese lay their eggs. And so there were all these rumors that still persisted that it grew out of driftwood, that it grew out of fungus, so it's this moment in history, and this is part of what drew me to the story, where they're kind of between these major, major discoveries about the world and this existence in which faith is still at the heart of everything and the way you understand everything. So these guys are, you know, religiously minded. They are still part of that world. They pray together regularly. And they're also very open to not just panicking in the face of the unknown, but to kind of scientifically analyzing it. They see what we sometimes call sun dogs, what are called parhelia, where it looks like there's multiple suns in the sky at one point. And instead of just panicking, they start measuring how high is it above the horizon. They're describing it like in great detail. They later in about this time of year, actually, a few weeks earlier in the year than we are now, but they had gone through polar night and they were waiting and waiting for the sun to return to them because they didn't have any sun at all for months. And it actually comes up weeks early. And they know the star charts. Barents knows this stuff very well. He knows it's physically impossible for the sun to be coming up 2 weeks early in this part of the northern world. And yet they see the sun, and they can't explain what it is they're seeing, but they document it. They document how high it is, where it is, when they see it. And for hundreds of years, their account is sort of the whole thing is called into question because of the story of the sun. And they think, these guys must have been making this up. Therefore, maybe they made a lot of this up. Maybe, you know, a whole bunch of this isn't true. And it wasn't until well into the 20th century when Fridtjof Nansen saw the same effect. It's now called the Novaya Zemlya or Nova Zembla effect, in which a kind of refraction tunnel gets set up where the sun is actually below the horizon, but it kind of gets refracted its way up. So then you see a reflection of it almost in the air above the horizon. You're not really seeing the sun, but you're seeing sort of this bending tunnel of light that is showing you where it is on the other side of your horizon. So they found science that was not explained for centuries after they sailed, but by writing about it just in detail and sort of dispassionately, they actually gave us a tremendous amount of knowledge long before anybody else would bring it to us.
You also mentioned a number of times where they describe the Arctic at times as teeming with wildlife, whales all over the place. Polar bears took over their ship while they were icebound. That's obviously different today, isn't it?
It is. And one of the things that I say toward the end of the book, there's kind of a coda that goes through the trips that I took and what I saw and then how it relates to what they experienced. And one of the things that I say is that, you know, Barents was kind of the first big wave because the story became so famous. It was translated into many different languages. He sort of became the first wave of this opening of the high Arctic, because after he sails, as I said, whaling comes to that section of Spitsbergen and Svalbard within, you know, a decade after he sails, and it never stops after that. So Europeans after that are always in the high Arctic. There's always something going on, and for the first couple centuries, it is this huge whaling project that happens, and we fish the right whale almost into extinction up there. I mean, it still has not recovered. The polar bears that you described, the walruses, there's still a lot of walruses up that far north, but the effect that we've had on the Arctic wildlife there, I quote one historian who told me in an interview you know, with the way that European explorers responded to what they met, it's a wonder that anything is still alive. And so we had this tremendous toll that we took right away, but it goes deeper than that, because that was also, Barents going was also part of this larger attempt to sort of follow in the footsteps of Spain particularly, but also Portugal in colonizing the Americas and making the trade missions to the east, that other countries were going to get into it as well in a significant way. And this is the moment in history where it becomes inevitable that the whole globe is going to be colonized. And with that, you have these colonies with raw materials, you have importing raw materials, industrialization becomes possible, and it's that industrialization that leads us in the end to the climate change that we're facing right now, which is as phenomenal a force and an outcome as humanity has ever unleashed in history, is this. And so part of what I talk about at the end is how everything has resulted in the wake of Barents, not just due to him, but everything that followed him has led us to this moment where we're losing the species, we are losing the ice, and that voyage he hoped to make through an open polar sea that he thought was there 400 years ago, perhaps he just sailed 400 years too soon, because everything that he did and everything that followed is actually created that sea that he imagined was there. And scientists are saying by 2040, maybe quite sooner than that, there will be no ice in the North Pole in the summertime at all. It'll freeze back in the winter, but it'll be a totally open polar sea in the summer. And there was just a story yesterday about the first February navigation without an icebreaker from China around to a major port city in Russia. So this exact sort of part of the world that Barents was in, we are now seeing this ability to navigate there. And it's going to change our world to have that open Arctic navigation just as much as Barents' trip did his world. I think you're going to see a lot of things, national security fights, territory, you know, disputes, all kinds of things are going to happen because of this Arctic that has changed so dramatically.
And havoc for the natural world.
Yes, for sure. Part of my hope with this book, I mean, it's an amazing survival story, and I think that's the first level that most people should and would read it on, but also to understand the implications of these kinds of voyages and this history and what that European presence has meant in the Arctic, because we're really coming up on the last years to do significant things to preserve what's left. You know, we've already lost a tremendous amount. It is still possible to do a lot to protect what is still there. And it isn't just a matter of liking polar bears and wanting to keep polar bears. A more stable Arctic will mean a more stable planet for the rest of us. And scientists have made clear, this is not just me, that we are going to, with the Arctic changing much more quickly than the lower latitudes, with that destabilized Arctic, we are going to see more extreme weather in the weather events we have, and possibly more frequent freak weather events as well.
The name of the book is Icebound. Andrea, it's good to speak with you again. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rich.
Historian and journalist Andrea Pitzer speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her latest book is titled Icebound, Shipwrecked at the Edge of the World. It's published by Scribner's. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.